This is Stephen Whitaker and Eddie Chang back again. We now have some special guests in the studio, two gentlemen from Sudan. Because this is Genocide Awareness Day and not just Holocaust Awareness Day, we're going to be interviewing these gentlemen and talking about their life in Sudan and in America during the genocide there. We have Michael Cooch and James Luol. Did I pronounce those correctly?
Right.
All right, thank you, sirs. And Eddie Chang, why don't
you
go ahead?
So since Mr. Began told us that this information is not correct, would you like to fill us in your story?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the information is correct. There are just few things that we were able to correct. And do you want me to just...
Just continue, please.
It was just the... On the flyer that said that we were Darfur survivors, we were not Darfur survivors, but very similar situation in Darfur happened in southern Sudan. That's where we're from. So we were the survivors from the civil war in southern Sudan. And so that is very similar to what is currently happening in Darfur. The difference is that when the civil war happened in southern Sudan, there was no media coverage as it is in Darfur currently. But the atrocities, which were the bombings of the villages by the government in Khartoum, the landmines, the abduction of children and raping of women and all those atrocities that are currently or that you read in the news today in Darfur or the similar situation in southern Sudan. The way we were affected was, just as briefly as I said, our villages came under attack. We happened to be from one place in southern Sudan. We come from a place known as Bor in southern Sudan. We both live in a village, and because of the leader of the SPLM, who live in Bor, happened to be from our tribe, or tribe came under attack.
I'm surprised at how fluent you are in English. Can you just tell me where did you learn English so well?
Well, I went to school here in the United States. Uh-huh. I've been in America since 2000, and I went to high school here, just finished college recently. I spoke some English, maybe British accent a little bit, but we did speak some English before we came here.
Would James like to talk a little bit about his experience, or?
Well, that's exactly what Michael Cooch just said. That's the situation in Sudan is very similar with the situation in Darfur. And what we have experienced is very similar with what is going on with the people in Darfur. And so very much I think that's what the journey that what driven us out of the village all the way to United States is the same genocide threat.
Can you describe to us life before this genocide? How life was?
As Michael Cooch mentioned earlier, that we were born and raised in the village.
Right.
And so life in the village was very different from the modern life. And so our life, like our parents were basically pastoralists. That means they were animals keepers. You know, the only thing that we would have is just to have animals like cows, goats, and sheep. And also the other way of living would be farming. So our life was very surrounded with all that kind of situations. We didn't have all these grocery stores whereby if you need food, you had to go to grocery store to get some food. So what we usually have is the backyard, what you grow in your backyard, that's your own food. And so our life was very, very, very much surrounded that way, pastoralist way of living.
Now, I understand both of you are survivors of the civil war in Sudan. Not too many people know about this particular event in history, so could you just kind of tell us what you experienced during this time period in your country?
Well, I sort of pointed that out earlier. When currently, Sudanese personally, I could say we are fortunate that there is a lot of coverage on the Darfur issue, and a lot of high school, like this high school, across the nation, colleges have been able to participate and play their share as they should as a result of the media coverage of Darfur. In southern Sudan, however, we did not have that type of coverage. It took 22 years in southern Sudan for the international community to actually do something. You have about 2 million lives lost in that conflict. In Darfur, you have 200,000 lives lost, and tripling those numbers are the displaced. So as we speak to students today, that is the message. We hope that more American students, more American citizens are aware of what actually happened in southern Sudan. No one ever called it anything besides just calling it a tribal clash or on and off internal conflict, when in fact the government was behind all the atrocities that happened in southern Sudan. As a result of that war, we were forced to walk miles, hundreds of miles from our home villages, particularly from Bor area, across the desert, which took us 3 months. We were very young at the time, I was age 5, and we were confronted with all the kinds of hardship you can think of. We did not, because we were attacked in the middle of night, we were separated from our family members, I was separated from my parents and my siblings. I was not prepared for the trek, and so that meant I did not have food, I had no shoes on, no clothes, and we were faced, because it was during dry season, we had to face a lot of heat. It was very hot, a lot of winds, and we're going towards Sahara Desert, which spirals in the northern part of Africa. A lot of people died as a result of hunger, thirst, in some cases attacked by wild animals. So that is essentially what happened, and we would take the same trek back as a result of another war in Ethiopia that would happen later on after we arrived in a refugee camp.
And could you just describe for us, either one of you, life in a refugee camp? What was that like for you two?
Life in the refugee camps was very, very miserable, as I could say it. First, when we first settled, you know, the refugee camp that we're talking, it's not like a camps where you will go and meet people and stay with people. The refugee camps that we lived in used to be a places where open places with from the scratch. We just go and start from the scratch, from zero. And then we start, you know, putting like little huts for ourselves. And so sometimes it's very difficult for people to understand what kind of refugee camp. Some people would thought that these are the camps where we would just walk into a family, you know, into a city, and then people in the city will welcome us and let us stay in these houses. These refugee camps are like totally, from this crash where we just go and sit there, and then we start making it as, you know, as habitat as possible to live in. And so life in, let's say, the first refugee camp that we first settled in Ethiopia was just from zero level. We started, and we started going to school there. That's where we start learning English. And so starting at that particular point, the school that we used to have, we didn't have buildings or anything of that nature. So we started going on to school under the trees. So trees would have to be our shelters. And the same thing to chairs, you know, we have these comfortable chairs at school here and everywhere you go. We didn't have chairs then. We used to get stone to sit on as our chairs. And first of all, we started without school stationaries, like pencils, books, textbooks, and many others. Until later on, the United Nations started bringing us school supplies. And there were a few in number. Of course, we had to split a pencil into two so we could share. The same thing to a notebook, 48 pages, so we could share. And also the same thing to water condition, too. Let's say the refugee camps in Kenya, water situation was also a very big issue. You would see a big line, people lining up in the morning. Like earlier, you had to get up early at 4 to be in line so that you could grab some water. Otherwise, you will stand in line for hours and hours to have water in your container. And most cases, you would end up having no water until you had to go and beg drinking water from your neighbors or your friends. And the same thing to food situation too. A gallon of corn, we used to call it maize back there. And so that gallon of corn, you have to, you know, use it wisely for 15 days. But that gallon, it doesn't last 15 days. So most of the time, it lasts you only 10 days or less than that. So most people, you know, decided to eat only once a day. So your ration could last you 15 days. And the same thing to a clinical situation too. The camp in Kenya, when we first started it, it used to be only one clinic. And so one clinic with 16,000 lost boys when they first got in the camp. So you will see people dying of preventable diseases because there's no medicines available, and also because of big lines. Sometimes they will just take somebody in, anybody who is coming, like being carried by on the shoulder to the clinic, they will take them as a first priority. And then those who came walking, they will just say, well, you guys could handle tomorrow or next day. And so those were the situations, briefly, the life in the refugee camps that we encountered.
Now, Michael, I understand that it says in the packet that you've experienced and you've seen some of the horrors of war and during the Civil War. Would you like to just fill us in on what some of the atrocities are?
Well, those things would be similar to... I just came from listening to one of the speakers today, and he was a Holocaust survivor. The situation, and as James just mentioned some of the things, the living situation in a refugee camp, are not very different from those some of the camps that you hear of the Nazis. Now, we were safe out of the war zone, so that's one of the major differences. But as far as not having the basic human rights, and those are not having water, which is a basic human right, not having enough water. As James just mentioned, there were few water taps, and you would see queues, lines, extending miles for people trying to fetch simple human right of water. We did not have enough food. We were given food rations, just like was done in the Nazis camps, where the soldiers or those people that were prisoner of war were given food rations. So people were starving. There was no water. We were very young, at age 5, and seeing people dying, you know. Having to bury your own friend at that very young age, and then seeing them being shot or being killed or just dying of thirst or hunger. Those were some of the horrible situations that I had to encounter. In addition to people just, making wrong choices. I had friends who ate mud just to be alive because there was not enough water. They thought eating mud would quench their thirst. And as a result, the mud sat in their stomach and they died. People ate poisonous fruits, things that they should not have eaten. And of course, a lot of young people of my age chose to go to the army. And they went to the army to fight. And a lot of my friends didn't see, there was no fear. You know, when you were very young, you've seen your family member being shot or killed, or seen your village set to fire, you have that bitterness. You want a revenge. And a lot of my friends simply chose guns instead of pens. And as James said, we obviously didn't choose that path, and we stayed in school in refugee camps. We were able to finish primary school and secondary school and college. A lot of my friends were not able to make it alive because of the decision they made, and something that I couldn't blame them, but sympathize with what they had to go through.
We are actually running out of time now. You gentlemen have to get to another speaking engagement, but just as a closing remark, could you just reiterate to us the message that you're trying to convey to students today at Schreiber High School?
If I may, first of all, James and I are very delighted that we were able to share this special day with you guys today, and among many other speakers that had to talk to you. And we just came from a gentleman, I think his name was Mr. Horwitz. He was one of the Holocaust survivors who had a very moving testimony, making almost, even though some of us, James and I, who have experienced similar horrible situation back in Sudan, to see that he went through worse as well. So our message being here today is to be able to make sure that the young Americans, the American students particularly, learn these issues of war. In many cases, besides the Holocaust survivors, in many places where war is waged, whether be it in Sudan or Iraq, Rwanda, anywhere in the world where war is waged, the victims, the most victims of war are usually children and women. And so our main hope is to see you guys, the leaders of tomorrow, make sure we well equip you to know that war is never the means. War is never justifies the means. There are many ways to solve differences. So our hope is to make sure that you understand that war affects children, war affects women and the age. And so it's wise to not to use war the last resort as possible.
It's a powerful message. Thank you so much for coming, Michael and James.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
This is Eddie Chang and Stephen Whitaker. We'll be right back.